now call upon E. Hardy, the SPGB, to
open. Well, Mr. Chairman, comrades, I shall say what my opponent said, that there's a lot of ground to be covered, and it won't be possible to cover all of it. A lot of these things that you have listened to, I mean, that this alleged belief of the SPGB that you can have socialism in one country, or this alleged belief that all you've got to do is to send people to Parliament, I mean, this is just nonsense, has no relation whatever to the case of the SPGB. But I will hope to deal with our case and the case put forward by ICC in their written propaganda, stage by stage, in order to bring out the real essence of it. I want to make a reference at first to Marx and Engels. The SPGB stands on its own feet. Our case is our own. But we're very much indebted to what Marx and Engels wrote, and I noticed that my opponent made a number of quotations from Marx about in support of their case. What I'm going to show is that while we, the SPGB, have built our case, developed it further from the mature views that Marx and Engels reached after 50 years of experience, political experience, that the ICC are taking the views of the immature Marx and Engels. And I shall hope to develop that case. I'll just say one thing. You will have heard my opponent refer to the dictatorship of the proletariat. The dictatorship of the proletariat was invented by a Frenchman, Louis Blanqui, who staged his first attempt at it in 1830. And the ICC are living back in 1830. They haven't noticed what has happened to the world since. I want to just refer briefly, and I think I'm not quite sure whether my opponent accepts this. Socialism as a working system of society has got to be based on voluntary understanding, cooperation by the mass of the population. You cannot have socialism until that understanding and willingness to cooperate is there. As I say, I'm not quite sure whether they're really accepting that, because when I read some of their written propaganda, they do not seem to see the implications of it. So the question arises is this: if you are going to hope to achieve socialism as understood by Marx and the SPGB, that is, a system of society in which there is no production for the market, no buying and selling, no wage labour, no prices, no armed frontiers, and all the rest of it, that you've got to have your working class mentally equipped and experienced to do it before you can have that socialism operated. So the question arises, how does the working class become equipped to take on this great task? There are two rival theories. Louis Blanqui, the view put forward by my opponent, was that you have a minority seizure of power, and your minority of seizure of power then educates the working class to introduce socialism later on. And in case my opponent thinks that, as he said, they are not in favour of a minority, I shall quote various statements from their publications in which, whether they have seen it or not, they are committed to undertaking minority action. But the later mature views of Marx and Engels, I will read to you from Engels, 1895, just before he died, in his preface, his introduction to Marx's class struggles in France. I quote from Engels: "The time is past for revolutions carried through by small minorities at the head of unconscious masses. When it gets to be a matter of the complete transformation of the social organization, the masses themselves must participate, must understand what is at stake and why they are to act. That much the history of the last 50 years has taught us. But so that the masses may understand what is to be done, long and persistent work is required. Socialists realize more and more that no durable success is possible unless they win over in advance the great mass of the people," which in this case, he happened to be referring to France, means the peasants. "The slow task of propaganda and parliamentary activity are here also recognized as the next task of our party." I shall refer again, you notice he refers to parliamentary activity, I shall refer again to this question of the peasants. And I want to emphasize that this is not an academic question. ICC write favorably of what happened in Russia in 1917 of Lenin, whatever they may think about anything that he may have done later. ICC are rejecting the view I led out to you, the Marxist view, that you've got to win over the mass of the population first before you attempt to attain power. ICC says, no, you don't wait for that. That's an illusion, they think. Well, I want to put a question to them. They are admirers of Lenin. Lenin made his position perfectly clear. Lenin was not going to wait for the majority of the working class. Lenin said, the mass of the workers are only capable of trade union consciousness. They are not capable of what he called social democratic consciousness, that is, of understanding socialism. Lenin said that the development of socialist ideas come, and I quote from Lenin's What is to be Done, not written towards the end of Lenin's life, but in 1903, they come from the educated representatives of the propertied classes, the intelligentsia. And he pinpointed this with that well-known statement of his, if socialism can only be realized when the intellectual development of all the people permits it, then we shall not see socialism for at least 500 years. I want to put a question to my opponent. They are not going to, they do what the SPTB says. The SPTB says, like Engels, you've got to win over the great mass before you seize power, because otherwise it's useless. Why does ICC reject the possibility of winning over the working class? Is it, like Lenin, that they just think the working class are not capable of it, that you've got to wait 500 years, even if then? Now, the second great obstacle to getting socialism, after you have won over people to understand socialism so that they could voluntarily cooperate in running a system of society, is this question of the machinery of government and the armed forces. The SPGB says, You've got to get control of the machinery of government and the armed forces before you can do anything. This, of course, you will find Marx putting all over the place, putting it in Capital and so on, and saying that you've got to get control of the organized force of society before you can do anything. Now, the SPGB's view is simply this, that you've got to win over your great mass of your population first, have them consciously and politically organized, as we say in our Declaration of Principles, and that they will send delegates to Parliament and councils and take over this machine. Now, I'm not going to say anything more at this moment. I shall come back to it. My opponent thinks this is quite impossible, that you can't do it. Now, use the argument, before I leave this, by the way, my opponent did refer to what Marx said in the Civil War in France as a result of the experience of the Paris Commune. But he didn't quite give you the full story of what Marx did say. Marx didn't say to the working class, you don't need to get control of the machinery of government and the armed forces. The words he used were that the workers cannot simply lay hold of it. Meaning, as he went on to say, they have got to lay hold of it, and then they've got to lop off its bureaucratic and military aspects. But he forgot, or he didn't use the point that Marx made in immediately following that in that particular work on the Civil War in France. He said, the few but important functions which would still remain for a central government were not to be suppressed as has been intentionally misstated. In other words, Marx is saying, as he did all along, and Engels and the SPGB, you've got to get control of the machinery of government, all these government departments, or the whole apparatus of it, including the armed forces, before you can do anything about introducing socialism. Now, my opponent makes a great point about the difference between Parliament and workers' councils, Soviets. He approves of workers' councils, the Soviets in Russia in 1917, the workers' councils in Germany in 1918. But ICC reject the idea of Parliament. They give the three reasons. One, they're not going to wait for the majority of the workers to become socialist. Second, that instead of gaining control of the machinery of government and the armed forces, they are going to confront the armed forces of the capitalist state. But thirdly, they use this argument that Parliament is mystification. In decadent capitalism, they say, Parliament and elections are nothing but sources of capitalist mystification. Any participation in the parliamentary circus can only reinforce this mystification in the eyes of the proletariat. There's a half-truth here. Of course the capitalist class use parliament to mystify the workers. They use everything else. They use sport and religion. They use economics. Is this a reason why we shouldn't study economics? Because the capitalists put over, and I'll come back to another point later, they put over the Keynesian rubbish to the working class. Of course it isn't. The moral of that is that you study economics from the Marxist point of view, you understand capitalism. Now Marx, this particular question was put to Marx and Engels about whether Parliament was mystification. You'll find Engels writing, "The revolutionary workers of the Latin countries have got into the habit of looking upon the franchise as a pitfall, as an instrument for government chicanery." Engels didn't say, like ICC, "therefore don't use it." Engels went on to say, "of course you use it." He quoted what Marx wrote. Marx wrote the preamble to the programme of the French Workers' Party. And Marx noted that the franchise in France had hitherto been a means of deception, what ICC calls mystification. But Marx went on to say, not don't use it, Marx went on to say, "they are now," and I quote, "transforming the franchise into an instrument of emancipation," which is of course exactly the case of the SPGB. But I'd like to say something else about this. My opponent draws a distinction between workers' councils, which he thinks are above this sort of thing, and Parliament, which isn't. He should read Lenin. Lenin, in State and Revolution, draws attention to the fact, this is 1917, that his political opponents were using the workers' councils, the Soviets, to bamboozle the workers. He said this, "they have managed to pollute the Soviets after the manner of the most despicable middle-class parliament." In other words, if you have got a working class who are not mature enough to resist it, they can be bamboozled anywhere, in political parties, in trade unions, on workers' councils, or anywhere at all. The only remedy for this is, of course, that the working class have got to understand socialism when they can no longer be bamboozled. Now, what my opponent said, it's got to be an armed struggle to confront capitalism and overthrow it. They call it world civil war. Well, don't be misled. Civil war is war. There's no distinction between the two. It's going to be fought, and I quote from them, by the armed workers' councils. "There will be military advances and offences and a vague indication of invasions, sending armed detachments into this or that region," and they add to this, "not making any concessions to nationalism or any pretended right to national self-determination." Well, let me remind you, while the SPGB says you've got to wait till the mass of your working class understands socialism, ICC says you don't wait. You move when some crisis happens like the present one. Well, if you are going to move while the workers are not ready, you are going to have workers all over the world who are nationalist and patriotic, peasants who want to seize the land and this sort of thing. And when ICC wages their war, they are going to have to fight these people. And they make one or two things perfectly clear. My opponent referred to the fact that there are countries where the peasants are in the majority. Quite true. Remember what Engels said, you've got to win over your peasants. ICC are not going to win over the peasants. They make a specific statement that when they have set up their workers' councils in the transition period, the peasants are not going to be allowed to share in power. In other words, your dictatorship is not going to be a majority, it's going to be, at least in those countries, a minority. But I would add further that they make it quite clear that this dictatorship of what they call the proletariat is going to be like Lenin's and like Louis Blanqui's, who invented the term, a dictation of a minority. ICC says, for example, that this will probably start in the third world countries. They say the workers and the peasants and others in the third world countries won't wait for the industrialized countries. In other words, it's going to start in those countries where the working class are not even in a majority. And their workers' councils are not going to let the peasants share in power. I quote from their pamphlet, Nation or Class, "the workers would have to prevent the peasants from attempting to share power with the proletariat." In other words, it's going to be a minority dictatorship. They also say in the same pamphlet, it will be, quote, a section of the proletariat which seizes power. And it will be the most revolutionary workers, not all the workers, it will be the most revolutionary fractions of the working class. In other words, this is going to be a minority dictatorship. And they're going to be faced with all the problems that a minority dictatorship is facing. I now want to draw something else, attention to something else about this transition period. Remember the Louis Blanqui's idea, you get your dictatorship of the proletariat in power, then they educate the working class. But ICC recognize that in their transition period, there is going to be capitalism all over the world. I quote from that same pamphlet, the experience of Russia has shown that not only is the construction of socialism difficult in one country, it is actually impossible, and they underline impossible. As long as global capital exists, it will continue to dominate all the rhythms of production and consumption everywhere. So capitalism is going to exist all over the world while you've got your minority dictatorship of the part proletariat running things. What I'd like to ask ICC is how they're going to manage distribution when they have got capitalism all over the world. Marx made that very brilliant remark of his, you cannot have capitalist production and socialist distribution. You can't play football under cricket rules, in other words. I put the question to the ICC, they are going to hold down the peasants and the mass of the workers. What about the workers who strike when the next crisis happens in this transition? Are they going to impose an incomes policy to hold wages down? Are they going to suppress the trade unions? I would like an answer to this question. We've had references to the crisis. This is a particular notion of ICC, that capitalism now is quite different from what it used to be. They give abundant evidence of it. They refer to the wave of strikes, unemployment, that the capitalist class can't handle capitalism. They should learn something about capitalist history. Everything they mention shows that capitalism now is just what it always was. A real change did take place in 1914. London ceased to be the military and political center of the capitalist world. It's moved over to Moscow, New York, Peking, Brussels, with the Third World and Middle East and such, and the others fast coming up. But football used to be played only in England. It's now played all over the world. That doesn't mean the decay of football. It just means it's extended. Capitalism now has not changed essentially. It's behaving exactly as it's behaved in its 200 years of history. They believe that, they use the phrase, the crisis, the present one, is deepening, that it's permanent, that the capitalist class are unable to deal with it. As I say, they ought to first read their Marx, and they should also read their Lenin, and they should understand something about capitalist history. This idea about capitalist crises being permanent, it's an ancient idea. It was being held by people in 1848, it was held by Heinemann in the 1880s. It's not Marxist, and as I say, it's not even Leninist. Marx's statement on this was, there are no permanent crises. Even Lenin knew this. Lenin said, revolutionaries occasionally endeavor to furnish the proof that there is absolutely no way out of the crisis. This is a mistake. There is no such thing as a situation from which there is no way out. And if you look at the evidence that ICC give that the capitalist world is different now, as I say, all it proves is that capitalism is not different now. If they're worrying about great crises and depressions, let them look at the Great Depression, which lasted for over 20 years, the longest and in many respects the worst crisis British capitalism has ever had, from 1873 into 1895. It was in the middle of that Heinemann gave a date for the revolution. It was to be 1889, centenary of the French Revolution, because it didn't happen. But also, there were capitalists who thought at that time, as ICC would say now, that already by the 1880s, capitalism is quite different. It wasn't the nice, smooth capitalism they thought existed at the beginning. Quite an illusion. Some of those believed it. Let me quote to you from Lord Randolph Churchill, 1884. "We're suffering from a depression of trade extending back to 1874. Did I say, 1884 he said this. Extending back to 1874, 10 years of trade depression, and the most hopeful either among our capitalists or our artisans can discover no signs of a revival. Your iron industry is dead, dead as mutton. Your coal industries are languishing. Your silk industry is dead, assassinated by the foreigner. Your woolen industry is in articulo mortis, gasping, struggling. Your cotton industry is seriously sick. The shipbuilding industry has come to a standstill. Turn your eyes where you will, survey any branch of industry you like, you will find signs of mortal disease." This was 1880s. So Heinemann had a very, very reasonable sort of case for saying that as it lasted 20 years, my God, capitalism's finished. ICC look at the present one, which is mild by comparison. The present crisis has lasted 4 years. Unemployment's 1.5 million. When the unemployment rises to 4 or 5 million and the depression's lasted 20 years, they could say, well, look, there's something to take notice of. But they should also remember, as Marx showed, that just as crises happen, they pass away. There is no such thing as a permanent crisis. The same forces that bring them take them away. One of developing the same idea that... coming back, by the way, to this idea of Parliament, in a leaflet which ICC got out on this present debate, they make the statement, very much like the one my opponent made in his opening speech. He said that the SPGB believes in a peaceful parliamentary conquest of power by the working class, and that this is an expression of the weight of bourgeois ideology on the proletariat. Well, he ought to know, as Marx and Engels held the same idea, bourgeois ideology must have impressed Marx and Engels. In 1886, and this wasn't in their early inexperienced days, but right at the end, Engels wrote in his preface to Capital, 1886, "Britain is a country where the inevitable social revolution might be effected entirely by peaceful and legal means." And he added, oh, by the way, Marx said the same about Holland. Engels added that Marx didn't rule out the possibility the capitalist class might stage a counter-revolution against this peaceful and legal takeover. But this is where the SPGB comes in. I said at the beginning, we've carried on. There's been a lot more things happened in the world since Marx and Engels died. We insist that you have got to, before you attempt to get power, you've got to win over the great mass of the population, and that it's a very slow business, but that there is no other way of doing this. But this, of course, includes all of the members of the working class, the police, the army, the soldiers in the army. They also can be won over. They are members of the working class. They don't live in some cloistered monastery, unaware of what's happening in the world. Just the forces that will move the working class to take a more... a nearer approach to full class consciousness will affect the people in the army and navy, that they will realize, and I use a phrase that particularly, they will realize that they are only workers in uniform, and that their effort should be brought onto the same side as the working class. But now, let's look at this a little realistically. Suppose you've got the situation, which is absolutely essential, you've got the mass of the population who do understand socialism, know what they want, and are going to do it. How does the capitalist class stage a counter-revolution? My opponent used the phrase that it has got to be a war between the bourgeoisie and the proletariat. Now tell me, how are the bourgeoisie on their own going to wage war or do anything else? Just imagine it. I mean, imagine the situation where all of these political argumentative questions have been worked out, when the working class is mature and knows what it's doing, is internationally organized and knows all about it. Just imagine some representative of the capitalist class. I mean, the obvious one to take is the chairman of the Confederation of British Industries, saying to the workers, look, you know, you've got this all wrong. we really represent your interests, and we are going to stage an armed counter-revolution against the decision of the overwhelming mass of the population. I mean, they could be have a certain nuisance value, but otherwise it's a joke. The bourgeoisie cannot wage war without the working class. Working class in industry, working class in administration, working class in all the armed forces to do it for them. One other thing. In developing their own case, and you will have heard my opponent refer to it, they are going to rely on the crisis to bring the working class, so to speak, into taking revolutionary action. I've already mentioned the Great Depression. I notice in one of their things they talk about the wave of strikes. Most impressive. In the last 4 years, the number of days lost in strikes in this country is 31 million, very large figure. This is the work of 11 million trade unionists. In the 4 years, 1893 to 1896, when there are only 1.5 million trade unionists, only 1/7 of what there are there, they knocked up a total of 49 million days. So this ICC belief that it's the workers moving into revolutionary now because they're striking over wages and prices, if that were true, and of course it isn't, it's not the key to the situation at all, they've got to look back into the 1890s to find when the revolutionary situation really happened. And we say against this, you do not have a revolutionary situation because workers strike about wages and prices. The capitalist class can always give them some concession, and the what they call a revolutionary wave, which is a discontent wave, passes away, as it always has done. I mean, you saw this happening in the 19th century and so on. But capitalism has not changed essentially. Capitalism is just the same as it always was. It operates in precisely the same way that it always did. One of their cases is, it's part of the same argument, that the capitalist class cannot afford reforms anymore. ICC doesn't understand capitalism and doesn't understand how the capitalists afford reforms. A lot of the reforms the capitalists give or appear to give cost them nothing. Probably the health service and education have cost the capitalists last nothing because they've raised the productivity of the working class. But this is the key to the situation. While the productivity of the working class goes on rising, while the output of each worker rises a little year by year, as it has continued to do and is doing now, of course the capitalist class can afford to give part of it to the working class as a concession. If the working class output in a year raises 4%, of course the capitalist class, without losing anything, in fact gaining something, can give 2% to the working class. This idea of the ICC, that you can get a revolutionary situation out of discontent, crises and things like that, is quite mistaken. I notice elsewhere, one of their statements is, that capitalism now has nothing to offer except cycles of crises, wars and reconstruction. To the extent that it is true, of course it's always true. When Louis Blanqui, their founder, their dictator of the proletariat, staged his first revolt in 1830, he could have said it then. He could have said in 1830, capitalism offers you nothing except a series of crises, wars and reconstruction. Marx and Engels were already writing in 1844 about the regular crises that had been happening in the capitalism. First one was in 1784, not 1884, 1784. Another in 1793. Heinemann, in his Commercial Crisis, lists 9 of them between 1815 and 1892. Capitalism always has crises, and as Marx says, none of them last forever. They all pass away. Reconstruction is not really important, but British capitalism had 2 major reconstructions in the 19th century. First, when it abandoned protection and went over to free trade in the middle of the century, and then in the 1880s and the Great Depression, when it started the reverse trend. I mean, this sort of thing is not really important. But also, they say capitalism offers you nothing but wars. When did capitalism ever offer the workers anything else but crises and wars? They say Marx and Engels were already saying in the Communist Manifesto 1848, they referred to the bourgeoisie's constant battle with the bourgeoisie of other countries. In the 1914 war, Arthur Ponson, who published a book called Wars and Treaties, 1815 to 1914, he listed and described 42 wars in the 19th century, and he said it wasn't a complete record. IOP and he gave his explanation. He said most people, and he's writing in 1917, most people seem to think that there were hardly any wars before 1914. ICC seem to have the same impression if they think that capitalism has essentially changed in that respect. Another idea people do have, and they've got it, is that the old wars are different. They're only little wars. They were not little wars. Let's look at some. Look at the Napoleonic Wars, lasted about 20 years. There were 6 million deaths in the Napoleonic Wars. If you allow for population, that was comparable with the First World War. Or look, their war is going to be a civil war, but as I said, don't be misled. People get killed in civil war just as in wars. Look at the American Civil War in the 1860s. The number of Americans who lost their lives in the American Civil War was more than America lost in the First World War and the Second World War taken together. And just one other example. In the 1850s, 60s, there was what were called the Taiping Wars in China. It was partly a peasant revolt, this order of interest ICC, a peasant revolt to overthrow the Manchu dynasty, and they captured a large part of China. They were eventually crushed with the help of British and French troops. The estimated deaths in the Taiping Wars were between 20 and 30 million, with 100,000 people killed in Nanking alone. So what I'm asking you to recognize, in all this, the whole of this argument that capitalism is different is a complete myth. Capitalism is essentially the same as it always was. I haven't been able to deal with all the things I want to. I'm hoping to deal in the following 10 minutes, the 10 minutes to come at the end, with another aspect of their war. They give you abundant evidence that they are going to lose their war when it takes place. I want to deal with this. I also want to deal with another important aspect. They claim to be Marxists, and I'm going to show from their own propaganda that not only do they not understand capitalism's crises and depressions, but that their claim to be Marxist betrays an almost total ignorance of Marxist economics. They also use another argument, another piece of complete myth. They say that what's going to provoke the present revolutionary situation is a shrinking world market. I hope to deal with that as well.